Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the Human Services Policy Committee to order. Members, please take your seat. I do note that we have a quorum present. Before we begin our agenda today, I would like to remind the committee of a few housekeeping items. Everyone in the audience must be seated when they are in the hearing room. Please know sitting or standing in the walkways or in the aisles. This would allow us to keep the accessible seating available for those who need it. Please leave all signs outside the hearing room. All testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided time to testify. I reserve the right as chair of the committee to impose a time limit on comments. Time limits are provided so that we can keep our meeting on time and hear from as many people as possible. We usually ask the room if there are further testifiers who would like to speak, but there may not always be possible. I will note that you can also see we have remote testimony that is available. This is a special occasion. We bear with us. We want to make sure that this is going to work well. However, sometimes technology is great and sometimes it isn't. So please bear with us as we use the technology today. Thank you for your understanding and adherence to the rules. The first item on the agenda today is approval of the minutes from our Wednesday, March 6th meeting. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Vice Chair Frederick moves the minutes from March 6th. Any questions or amendments? Seeing none, all in favor of approving the minutes for March 6, 2024, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Our first bill this afternoon is House File 4480 from Chair Noor. Chair Noor, if you'd like to come down to the testifier table and move your bill. I will note for the members and the public will be voting on this bill by 1:15 to keep things on time for our agenda today. Chair Noor.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to move House File 4480 to the General Register.
Thank you, Chair Noor. I understand we have a few testifiers that will be coming up. If you'd like to, first of all, explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a policy bill related to increasing transparency and accountability within nursing facilities in related organization transactions, particularly in regards to finances, operations, and ownership. This bill, one, it expands DHS authority to require both audited financial statements available and a working trial balance rather than one or the other. Two, it requires nursing facilities to disclose costs associated with real estate. Three, it repeals duplicative legislative report. That's all it does, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Chair Noor. I understand that we have several testifiers. Our first person that I have on the agenda is Val Cook. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for being here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, my name is Valerie Cook, and I am the Division Director for Nursing Facility Rates and Policy at the Department of Human Services.
Please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Noor. You kind of hit the highlight spots of the bill already. I'll quickly just try to walk through the various sections. Section 1, as was already mentioned, it's just clarifying that DHS has the authority to request both a working trial balance and an audited financial statement instead of one or the other. And secondly, it just requires disclosure of related organizations that provide any services, facility property, or supplies to the nursing facility, and it gives DHS the authority to request financial information from the related organization as well as the nursing facility itself. Just to add, the most common related organizations arrangements that we see involve management services and leasing of real property back to the operator of the nursing facility. This, I would just like to highlight, this section would be effective August 1st of 2024, and so this disclosure would happen for the annual cost report that for the reporting 12-month reporting period ending September 30th, 2024, and those cost reports are due in February of 2025. So that's the timing of this change. Section 2, this is a new requirement. It involves disclosure of actual lease and rental arrangements between a property owner and the nursing facility operator, where, as I already mentioned, this is a real common area for related party transactions between the two parties. And we do collect this information on the cost report, but it's not required because we don't use it in the calculation of the value-based reimbursement rate for nursing facilities. And so up to this point, we have had not had the authority to enforce and collect information about those lease arrangements. So that's new. And Section 3 is repealing a VBR evaluation and report that's currently in law. There was one more report due in 2025. And last session we passed, there was a rate study, a nursing facility rate study that was passed, and it was also due in January 2025. It was an oversight that this was duplicative. The rate study is actually an expansion of what was in the existing evaluation study of VBR, in that it requires us to look at rates for neighboring states, and again, it does also touch on this whole question about related organizations.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, I have Christine Sundenberg, if you'd like to please come forward. You'll have 2 minutes. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Please go ahead and introduce yourself and then begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members of the committee. I'm Chris Sundberg. I'm the Executive Director of Elder Voice Advocates. And we are a nonprofit dedicated to protecting the rights and improving the quality of care for elders and people with disabilities. Elder Voice Advocates supports enthusiastically House File 4480 and has provided a more detailed statement, which is in your packets. We're alarmed by a troubling trend where nursing homes are hiding their true profits by channeling money to associated businesses, all the while neglecting quality of care. Elder Voice hears often from families that have had their loved ones needlessly suffer and even at times die because of the poor care they have received. Despite the high cost for nursing home care, these instances of abuse and neglect persist in all care settings. In 2022, the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center received over 77,000 allegations of mistreatment. That's up from 70,000 the year before. Yet, in 2022, Minnesota nursing homes received $1.2 billion from Medicaid, while understaffing continues as a decades-long practice which is compounded by notoriously low pay, long hours, poor training, and the pandemic. A national study released last week found that 63% of nursing home profits were funneled to related parties through inflated prices. This deceptive practice involves overpaying for goods and services from connected companies, thus hiding the profits. This study makes three key points. First is nursing home total
spending.
Excuse
me, if you could, I'm sorry to interrupt, is we hit the 2 minute, if you could give quick wrap up.
The total spending increases over 20% for real estate and 24% for the management fees. In conclusion, I hope you can support this. It'll improve the quality of care for everybody in the nursing homes. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other testifiers who would like to address the committee? Not seeing any. Thank everyone for their testimony. Members, are there any questions or comments? Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be quick. This is a great bill, Chair Noor. Do you know, with all the requirements that are in here, which are really great for transparency, will they be posted and readily available for people to see where they will be?
Chair Noor.
On a website, maybe?
Thank you, Representative Adelson. I think Val is here, Val Cook, who is going to respond to that question.
Ms. Cook.
Representative Chair Fisher and Representative Adelson, I'm sorry, I couldn't quite hear. You were asking about posting information.
Representative Adelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. For what is being required in this, in terms of how the public will access the data that we're requesting to be posted for transparency, Have you worked with the agency on where this would be posted and how it would be made available to the public?
Ms. Cook.
Chair Fisher, Representative Adelson. Once we publish rates after cost reports are audited, that information is public information. The supporting document and things like that, we don't currently have plans to post all that information, but it does become public once the rates are published and the audits are done.
Representative Adelson. Further comments? Not seek. Oh, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will the partnerships be limited to Healthy Med? Would that be something that we would, you know, we heard about that the other day? Oh, sorry. Forget it. I'm on the wrong spot.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Keel. Not seeing any other Chair Noor, would you like to give a closing comments and renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, this is a good bill. I renew my motion to refer House File 4480 to the General Register.
Chair Noor moves to refer House File 4480 to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion prevails and the bill is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you to those who are testifying. Next on the agenda is House File 4073 from Representative Hansen. If you'd like to come down to the testifier table, we are hoping to get this bill done within the next 15 minutes. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Chair. And yes, I would like to refer House File 4073 to Human Services Finance, please.
Okay, very good. And would you like, from what I understand, I believe you have an A2 author's amendment.
Correct. And I would like to move the A2 author's amendment, please.
Okay. Would you like to give a quick brief explanation of the A2?
The A2 just gets the bill in the shape that I would like it to be in, including inserting that these changes would be approved upon CFSS implementation.
Okay, thank you, Representative Hansen. Any member discussion to the A2 author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A2 author's amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails and the author's A2 amendment is adopted. Back to House File 4073 as amended. Representative Hansen, please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Chair and members, for the opportunity to present House File 4073. This is a bill that will allow worker training and develop training services to be performed remotely under certain circumstances with the CFSS service once it's launched. You heard a bill from me similarly last year about doing some of these, so this may sound slightly familiar, and if it does, you are on the right track, because it is. This is a simple and straightforward bill. It's building on policy language that we passed last session. As you know, during the pandemic, qualified professionals or QP supervisory visits were allowed to be done virtually through video and audio calls to protect the health and safety of the PCA recipients and their loved ones. Last session, we passed the policy language that allowed them to perform them remotely at the request of an individual in the PCA program if they have a compromised immune system. This policy change received approval from CMS and for both Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services in November of 2023. And this bill would extend the option to worker training and development service with the CFSS program. CFSS is the program that will replace the PCA program starting this year, for those who don't know. The QP is replaced by the worker training and development in that CFSS program. It's important to note that the worker training and development is not a, quote, hands-on service, and the virtual visits would not be permitted without decision by the CFSS service recipient and or their responsible party. Virtual visits would require both the use of both audio and video and would not be allowed for the start of care visits, just to be clear about that as well. This bill allows for a person-centered approach and helps protect our most vulnerable and immune-compromised recipients, helping them stay safe while we navigate the current and future contagious conditions that exist. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Are there any testifiers that would like to address the committee on House File 4073? Not seeing any. Thank you. Members, any questions or comments? Not seeing any. Representative Hansen, any closing comments? And then you may renew your motion.
Chair, I think I'm in order for a reward of some kind. Because I think this makes the bill for the fastest bill this session. And I appreciate you and the committee not like hearing from testifiers. As you know, this is a good one, but I want to respect everyone's time given what's on the docket today. And so with that, I would renew my motion that House File 4073 as amended be referred to Human Services Finance.
Representative Hansen moves to re-refer House File 4073 as amended to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion is approved and House File 4073 as amended is re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. Our next bill on the agenda is House File 3954 from Vice Chair Frederick. If you'd like to come down to the table to move your bill, I'm hoping to be done by about 1:45. We'll allow 30 minutes for this bill right here. Vice Chair Frederick, if you'd like to go ahead and move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to lay over House File 3954 for possible inclusion in the Human Services Policy Omnibus.
Okay. Vice Chair Frederick, I understand you have an author's amendment, the A2. Would you like to move your A2 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A2 amendment. What it does is aligns the bill with a similar amendment that the Senate took, and it also extends the deadline till January of next year.
All right, very good. So, members, any discussions or questions to Vice Chair Frederick on the A2 author's amendment? Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, good amendment. I'm glad we're adding this to the conversation today, so I hope we can all support that. Thank you.
Very good. Any further comments or questions? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the A2 author's amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Motion is approved, and House File 3954 is amended with the A2 author's amendment. Vice Chair Frederick, if you'd like to go, if you'd like to please begin explaining your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I just want to actually say part of that amendment in extending the deadline is because of advocacy from Representative Baker, so I just want to thank him for his assistance on this bill as well. But I also want to thank everyone that's been involved, whether that is from MASH and the Sober Homes, from the Harm Reduction Coalition, to even some local doctors from my district that came up from Mankato to advocate for aspects of this bill, not even knowing this bill existed. They were advocating for the content in this bill. The bill does two things. One is very simple. Sober homes are required to have Narcan or some sort of opiate antagonist in that space. However, there's no statute that says it has to be in a very clear, easy to access place. And so this bill says it needs to be in a spot that's not hidden in some cabinet somewhere in the house. So that's the simple part. The second part, though, tries to establish best practices by allowing medication-assisted treatments and not just it allows for medication-assisted treatments, but it also allows for medication for co-occurring disorders, trying to look at people as a whole person, that multiple things can be going on, and to be able to help people with their recovery journey to allow them to have access to those medications while in a sober home. There is some concerns that were brought forward that some people were advocating for sober homes to be completely sober. Meaning nothing in them. And it's a fair critique. There's nothing about this bill that is looking to eliminate anyone's individual path to recovery. We all know that can look different for every single person who's in recovery. But an argument saying that sober homes need to be completely sober, where over 70% of them are already allowing some form of medication-assisted therapy, means that they're already not sober. And so what this is looking to do is to expand on that and, again, allow for medications for co-occurring disorders. And I just want to state again that there is, in a sober home, if you have one person that is, you know, taking some sort of medication-assisted treatment and you have another person who's not taking anything, those two things don't negatively impact each other. They can walk side by side in their recovery journey, and I just want us to recognize that too. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would say we can turn it over to testifiers.
Okay, very good. I understand we have a number of people who are looking to testify today. I'd like to let folks know that we will be having a two-minute limit on testifiers. So the first person I have is Edward Krumpotich. If you'd like to come down, please, to the testifier table. And then after Edward will be Wendy Jones. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Mr. Members, thank you for having me today. My name is Edward Krumpetich. I'm the chair of the Minnesota Harm Reduction Collaborative. The state of Minnesota saved my life. Despite being a former Maryland State History Teacher of the Year, a master's graduate, and a college athlete, I found myself in the grips of substance use disorder, battling homelessness on the streets of Minneapolis for about 6 long years, facing the devastating reality of HIV. Substance use disorder doesn't discriminate. It takes the lives of families, friends, and countless neighbors. Minnesota has invested millions of dollars in my care, 40-plus abstinence-based treatments, 25-plus detoxes, numerous hospitalizations, surgeries, and 20 stays in abstinence-based sober homes. It wasn't until a medical provider provided me co-occurring disorder medications, which acted both as a safe supply for my use of methamphetamine and also a co-occurring mental health disorder. I take a stimulant to treat a stimulant use disorder. I want to thank that doctor for thinking outside of the box, and I want to thank the state of Minnesota for paying $30 a month for that care compared to the upwards of $10 million the state has paid and compared to abstinence-based care. Let me share some crucial insight. ADHD, for example, increases the risk of someone developing substance use disorder by 5 to 8 times. I was an untreated youth. Treating ADHD is straightforward with best practices. In fact, all we're asking to do in this bill is to follow SAMHSA guidelines. Currently, sober homes in the state of Minnesota numbered about 200 with about 2,000 beds. There were 12,000 admissions, 12,000 people admitted for opioid use disorder in 2021. That's 2,000 beds for 12,000 people. And medications for opioid use disorder are the gold standard medications for opioid use disorder. There is no if, there is no but, there is no anything. Think insulin to diabetes and statin for heart disease. We would not deny our grandparents insulin. We would not deny our grandparents a statin. And we wouldn't deny my brother, who is no longer with us, a chance. But wait a second, we did. He didn't have the chance that I had. Neither did my friend Nico. And neither did my stepdad, who I just lost. We need to do something about the abstinence-only medications. I mean, abstinence-only restrictions and open up the market. Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to be here and sharing your experiences with us. Next is Wendy Jones, and after Wendy Jones, I have Dr. Ryan Kelly. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Jones. Thanks for being here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you so much, Chair Fisher and committee members. My name is Wendy Jones. I'm a person in long-term recovery from substance use disorder and the executive director of the Minnesota Alliance of Recovery Community Organizations, or MARCO. MARCO and recovery community organizations advocate for recovery-oriented system change. We reject the shame, stigma, and discrimination that have historically harmed our communities, and we are community advocates across the continuum of care, which is why I'm here today. I am testifying in support of HF 3954 for three reasons. First, substance use disorder is a chronic disease, and people in recovery want, deserve, and are legally entitled to parity with the care afforded to other chronic diseases. People who use medications for opioid use disorders as they are prescribed are protected by the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. The recovery community fought long and hard for inclusion in the ADA, and it is the recovery community's responsibility to uphold and to advocate for ADA protections for all its members. Second, we're in a time of great change. The science of addiction and recovery has advanced exponentially over the past quarter century, as has the nature and availability of substances that are killing us. Last year, our practices are changing across the continuum of care to reflect the world we live in today. Last year, SAMHSA released best practices for recovery housing that recommended operators not have any barriers or restrictions for residents to use prescribed medications for behavioral health or physical health conditions. SAMHSA also included specific strategies for recovery housing operators to integrate access to prescribed medications into existing environments. Finally, recovery is not a zero-sum endeavor. There are multiple pathways of recovery, and practicing one pathway does not take away from another. 12-step, abstinence-only, medication-assisted, and all the other recovery pathways can and must coexist if we are serious about addressing the addiction epidemic. Segregation of recovery pathways and recovery supports does not ensure equal access. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. Next, I have Dr. Ryan Kelly, and then after Dr. Ryan Kelly, I have Randy Anderson. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you for having me. My name is Ryan Kelly. I'm an internal medicine and addiction medicine physician. I work at the Community University Healthcare Center in Minneapolis. I'm also co-director of the Addiction Medicine Consult Team at the University of Minnesota Medical Center. You know, I work every day to increase access to people who are unsheltered, don't have telephones, don't have transportation. For my patients with substance use disorders, access to proven life-saving medications like methadone and Suboxone are key. For my patients, the harder it is to access housing, the more likely they die. For my patients, the harder it is to access these medications like methadone and Suboxone, the more likely it is that they die. Hence, making someone choose housing over these medications is beyond harmful. You know, as we've already heard, some people think of meds like methadone and Suboxone as replacing one addiction with another. So to emphasize their importance and argue against that, I'm going to make an analogy. You know, think of antibiotics. You know, back before antibiotics had been discovered, if someone had a serious life-threatening bacterial infection, yes, some people may fight it off, they may recover on their own, but many patients would die. Well, now that antibiotics have been discovered, if someone has a serious life-threatening bacterial infection, you know, risking death to try and recover on their own makes no sense. And when it comes to patients with substance use disorders, especially opioid use disorder, numbers even worse. Without access to medications like methadone or Suboxone, someone with opioid use disorder, well over 90% of people will relapse over time. They will not recover. Hence, I want to emphasize the importance of these medications and that forcing people to choose housing over these medications is harmful. And then finally, I just want to really emphasize the importance of easy access to naloxone. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, I have Randy Anderson, and after Randy Anderson will be Will Lichen. Thank you for being here today. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and committee members, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Randy Anderson. I'm a state-licensed alcohol and drug counselor, a board member for the Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy, appointed by Governor Waltz, a peer recovery specialist trainer, and a supervisor. More importantly, I'm a person living in long-term recovery, and what that means to me is I haven't used drugs, alcohol, or any mood-altering substance since January 9, 2005. None of the above mentioned would have been possible if I hadn't been offered treatment for my substance use disorder while on federal pretrial release awaiting sentencing for my drug-related crimes. Initially, I didn't seek treatment to find recovery. It was simply a means of avoiding jail time. However, over the course of 10 months within what was initially intended for a 60-day treatment program, something clicked, and I found myself on the path to recovery. During my participation in that treatment program, I resided in a safe, chemical-free environment where medications like Valium, Xanax, Ambien, Vyvanse, Adderall, and other highly addictive prescriptions were prohibited or inaccessible. I feel immensely fortunate that such a supportive environment existed because had any of the fellow residents possessed those medication, I recognize that I would have attempted to obtain and misuse those medications to fuel my own addiction. There was an A1 amendment, which didn't go through today, but I feel with that amendment, chemical-free housing would have continued to be available resource, providing individuals like me a safe haven. However, under the A2 amendment, this crucial option could be lost, and I strongly believe it would result in more harm than good. Opioid overdose deaths persist at alarming rates, necessitating a comprehensive approach. Research from the National Institute of Health indicates that medications for opioid use disorder, such as methadone and Suboxone, can reduce overdose deaths by 30 to 59%. Therefore, it makes logical sense that all sober homes permit these medications. In today's discourse, we emphasize the concept of multiple pathways of recovery, celebrating all routes individuals may take. If we truly embrace and understand this principle, it is my personal and professional opinion that the current bill, either on its own or with the adoption of the A2 amendment, fails to honor my pathway, my recovery, my choice, and that of many others. Eliminating a choice or pathways to recovery runs counter to our ideals. Let's ensure we preserve diversity in recovery options. Thank you for your time, attention on this important and very personal topic.
Thank you for the input. I will mention that we do have the A1 amendment that will still be coming up after we are done with our testimony. We do have one more testifier before us right now. Will Lichen, please come down. Thank you for being here today. If you'd like to please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and committee members. My name is Will Lichen, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Sober Homes, also known as MASH, a nonprofit dedicated to certifying, inspecting, training, and supporting sober housing in our state. We enthusiastically support the A1 amendment. However, we are opposed to the unfunded mandate in House File 3954. A one-size-fits-all approach to recovery will not work. If the state wishes to support medication-capable sober housing, there are many better alternatives besides mandating another model out of existence. States such as Indiana, New Hampshire, and others have robust offerings for medication-supportive housing through incentives and training. I'd like to pay attention specifically to medication capability, because admitting them is one part of it, while being capable to supervise is incredibly important. Medication capability includes verifying prescription, ensuring HIPAA compliance, suppressing medication diversion, counting medications, and destigmatization training. It is absolutely critical that we all embrace a yes-and approach to recovery. Every recovery journey is unique, with many variations in structure, faith, program, and medication. Preserving the choice for an individual to reside in a home free from addictive substances is incredibly important. There is a need for more high-quality sober housing capacity in Minnesota. Once this is addressed, there will be plentiful options for individuals utilizing all medications and for those who wish to be in an environment free from addictive medications. Moreover, the environmental scan on sober housing has not been carried out. Having data on medication usage in sober homes should be a prerequisite to any drastic legislation or mandate. MASH has provided a one-pager that includes preliminary data that we have gathered from MASH-affiliated organizations, as well as a diagram illustrating the NAR levels of homes. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have regarding that document. Many NAR Level 1 and 2 sober homes in Minnesota are not properly equipped or trained to effectively oversee addictive medications. Their quality may be compromised, or they may end up having to close their doors. Any reduction in sober home beds in the state is a lethal danger that must be avoided. MASH is committed to and capable of ensuring that sober homes in Minnesota have adequate training, oversight, and support. We must embrace person-centered practices that allow for consumer choice, small businesses to thrive, and for all recovery residents to have the support they need to thrive in recovery. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Are there any other testifiers that would like to address the committee? Yes. I see several out there. If you'd like to come down to the table, and the second gentleman, if you'd like to come down in line here, you have 2 minutes. If you'd like to please introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
Chair Fisher, committee members, my name is Chris Edrington. I'm the owner of a company called St. Paul Sober Living. I operate 105 beds in sober living, mostly in Minnesota, some in Colorado. I'm in support of this bill. Representative Frederick and Baker have been super, super helpful with us at MASH. I'm also on the MASH board. And I want to acknowledge that we are in discussions, and it's been really, they've opened their doors to us, and it's been great. I want to address something, a couple of things specifically. When it comes specifically to medications in sober homes, I want to make it clear that MASH member operators are not against it. I don't know that there's a sober house resident in Minnesota not on some form of medication to treat their addiction, mental health, or other needs. When you hear MAT, or medication-assisted therapy, it often usually refers to medications like Suboxone, Sublocade, Vivitrol, and Naltrexone. These have been very helpful to thousands. We are not against MAT. There are many drugs that are regularly prescribed by physicians to help those in recovery with co-occurring conditions. We are 100% in favor of these and effective in treating our people. We are for anything that helps us with this horrible, deadly, awful disease. There are hundreds of sober home residents right now in St. Paul doing quite well accepting MAT, and those residents would have otherwise not made it very far. There are some medications that can be problematic for the residents of some homes. These meds are not necessarily considered MAT, prescribed specifically for the help with addiction. Often they are prescribed for disorders or conditions like depression, anxiety, and ADHD. Of course, we understand the need for these meds. We encourage our residents to use the amazing mental health resources here in Minnesota. We have years of experience with some issues with these drugs. So to keep everyone in the home safe and comfortable as possible, early sobriety is messy, it's not easy, and there are a lot of pitfalls. We are asking to have all options available, to have choice, to allow some homes to decide if a particular medication is not a fit for their population. Again, this is not in any way a rebuke of the doctors who may have prescribed them. There are simply some medications that create a difficult context for some in early recovery. Some of you may not know, but have had...
Excuse me, I'm sorry. We hit the two-minute mark. If you could give a concluding sentence,
I will. I just wanted you to know that I'm also the vice president of NAR, which is the National Association of Recovery Residents, and MASH is a state affiliate of that national organization. There are 30 other states that have MASHs doing this stuff very well. We have lots of resources, lots of experts, and we can bring that to the table to help figure this one out.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Okay. And then finally, welcome to the committee. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. We do have a two-minute limit.
Fair enough. My name is Eric Smedstead. I'll give you my qualifications. One, I'm a U.S. Air Force veteran. I'm a manager and director of four recovery homes, St. Paul Spirit House. I'm also a CPRS. I also advocate for guys in court. I'm certified in harm reduction. I have well over 1,000 hours volunteering directly in the recovery community, and I was the only manager involved in the 2023 Sober Home Study. And more importantly, I'm very involved in sober living today. I'm mainly going to talk about the A1 amendment, which is coming up. So that amendment proposed does best represent recovery today when we talk about person-centered and culturally responsive to an individual's recovery needs today. What makes this amendment a solution is that it opens up more recovery paths when it comes to recovery homes for people suffering from SUD and also gives them a choice when searching out a recovery home that best fits their recovery path and needs. The other important issue of culturally responsive is covered with this amendment, as we are not just talking about our native culture, but the culture of recovery in the home itself, which is vital in terms of successful recovery in a recovery home. I also believe that sober homes can still keep the models that have proven to be successful in recovery while supporting SUD and MAT treatment without the worry of addictive medications being brought into the home that residents may have abused in the past, which could be a triggering scenario. The amendment also helps an area which I don't hear much about. It's giving referring agencies more options for clients when searching out a home. This is one of the major problems of being able to give a number of choices to a client on their particular need, is when it comes to person-centered practice of recovery, when the path requires medication. This amendment will save lives and also keeping the option of choice for the most important part, it comes to recovery of the person. I would also like to state that I do not have stake in ownership of recovery homes. I am a resident and a manager. I am here today for the residents only. I believe that we need to give residents the best opportunity possible for recovery, especially when it comes to recovery residents. I am in support of the amendment based on it gives people like me a better opportunity for recovery while still keeping people's choice alive. And one more. If there's anything I can do to help this body understand recovery living better through thousands of hours of lived experience in the community, I freely would volunteer my time. I would also like to thank Representative Baker for the amendment proposed today. This amendment will save lives. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you so much for your testimony, sir. Next, we will now go on to dealing with the A1 amendment. Who will be offering the A1? Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I want to thank Representative Frederick for bringing the bill forward. I signed on this bill for a reason. It's important work that we're doing to bring the reality of the therapies that are available today to the world of recovery. And again, my signal to the communities that I work with a lot, and I've been to a number of sober homes, is that not one is the same. I think that what I've learned after listening to a lot of different people in that is that, like, my journey with understanding what is this medicine that's helping people stay sober. This is a big deal. This methadone, Suboxone, Vivitrol, it's all really important. But what also there is, and again, to the case of this, there's also medications that help people in recovery, like more addictive type things like Adderall and other anxiety medicines and things. Here's where we're at in this with the whole world. And I've been on the phone a lot this weekend, also with Representative Frederick. So we're talking about this, and we're going to get this right. But I wanted to make sure the A1 was offered today. I hope it can be accepted to go forward, because this needs to be part of our conversation. But what I'm trying to do with this amendment is make it all the therapies are part of this. We're not arguing that at all. It's just it's allowing a sober home, though, to carve out some areas that they're not happy with or they're concerned with. Some homes don't have the management levels or the oversight that others do. And we have to recognize that as the real world out there. These sober homes are very fragile, and they are the first, sometimes one of the most critical parts of a person's recovery after in treatment. we need to make sure that we listen to our owners and our managers like we've done today. And I just want to just offer this up that I'm still supporting this some way, but it took me a while to get where I'm at with the therapy treatments and how it's really working. But right now, these folks are saying, on this little piece of it, let's hold off on this. So I think we should take this forward. I hope the committee accepts the A1 because I think it's a small percentage of the people right now that are in recovery using these addictive type things. Again, I'll use the Adderall for an example. It's important for some people to use. I'm not saying it's not. Right now, today, 68% of our sober homes are allowing treatments, therapies into their homes. Not everybody, but this bill will get everybody in this, at least on that core therapy method. Okay, so I think that our sober home world has come a long ways that way. So I hope that the author will look at this as a very friendly amendment. Again, we are committed, I know Representative Frederick and I, to get this right. I think this part of this conversation will be helpful. And so I offer this up for discussion, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. I'll go to Vice Chair Frederick and then Representative Edelson. Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Baker. This is a space that I really enjoy working with you on. You have a different kind of thought process for some of this than I do, which is, I think, valuable. I want to say before this bill, from where Minnesota currently sits, this amendment moves in the same direction as my bill, right? We're moving in the same direction with this amendment or without this amendment, and I am grateful for that. I think what the difference between what my bill does before versus after the amendment would be just how far that we go down that path. So with this bill getting laid over, one of the things that that we talked about this morning and that I'm still committed to is we've had lots of conversations. Representative Baker and I have had lots of conversations with the sober homes, with all these different stakeholder groups. And one thing that we haven't done is pull literally everybody into the same room. And so one thing that I'm committed to doing is I know we have a very short timeline because it's hard to believe how far we are into session already. But getting that meeting set up, getting everybody at the same table and trying to work through and trying to tweak the language as much as we can to improve it as much as we can. I don't know how that amendment necessarily would align with some of the things I did with my amendment. So for now, I would ask the committee to vote down the amendment, knowing that there's going to be a meeting set up. If there's a way to improve it, I'm committed to improving this more in the future. And that's an invitation to everyone else, too, that's in the room that's testified on this bill. I think it's important that both sides hear each other, and I'm committed to making the improvement where we can.
Okay, thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. Representative Edelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Frederick, because I was just going to say, my sons have ADHD. They need Adderall. And when they don't have it, they don't operate in the way that works for them. So as a therapist, I would have real concerns if we're having this discussion and a prescriber has prescribed something, a medical doctor, and we're going to say you can't, that's not included in sobriety. Now, you could argue Adderall's addictive, or you could argue that it's not. I think in both frames, I'm glad that you're going to pull everybody into a room, because I love that. That's my favorite thing to do.
Yep.
Pull them all into a room and make sure a doctor is present, because we're talking about co-occurring issues. People oftentimes get involved, or they get into addiction because they're medicating. And so I just want to make sure that we have some medical professionals in there as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. Before I go to Representative Baker, I just want to say that, yes, I do know that we've got deadlines on getting the first bills out next week. I'm happy to hear that you're going to bring everybody together. I would like to say, though, even if we don't quite get this done by next week, that whatever the bill is that this is incorporated into, we'll continue to work going forward, because this will go to the House floor and we can still make more changes from there. So I do want to encourage people to continue to working together on it. And with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Baker for any final comments.
Yeah, and thanks, Mr. Chair and others. I think Representative Edelson said it well. There's nothing wrong with folks using Adderall and other things like that. That's not what I'm intending to say here. But there's not 100% of the homes are ready for this, because it is a very addictive style of a drug that can be abused easily. And they see this firsthand in these sober homes today. The problem is that the bill mandates 100% of our sober homes to do this. I'm just saying, let's walk before we run. Let's, because right now 60% of them likely are okay with taking the Adderall side of things, the whole package. Not all of them. This one size fits all is not right for everybody. So while I'm really disappointed that we're not taking the amendment, at least to further conversations, to send a signal to our stakeholders on both sides of this issue, I think that's what we should be doing, is like, okay, this is an option. When we get all done on the House floor, you may decide, Representative Frederick, that's not part of your bill. And then we'll have the vote the way the vote is. But it's not for 100% of the sober homes today are not ready for that, for everything. So I know we'll get to a better place. I'm disappointed that we're not going to accept the A1. I still want to see, I'm not going to call a roll. I really think this is important to see where the committee stands on this, but I want to see this move forward because I think this conversation will give an indication to the people that are doing this every single day, what is the committee going to do? And if we take it forward, members, we can always take it out later too. So it isn't like you're stuck. We're not. Let's be flexible. Let's do this in a bipartisan fashion, but this is what we should be doing. And I am so committed to working with Representative Frederick on this issue. I know he knows that. And so with that, I do hope that we will accept the A1 to take it further and in our commitment to working this better. But every single sober home in Minnesota is not ready for the full gamut. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baker. With that, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
The motion does not prevail, and the A1 amendment to the House File 3954 is not adopted. Further discussion on the bill as amended by the A2 author's amendment. Not seeing any. Vice Chair Frederick, any closing comments, and please renew your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I would say is to all the sober home stakeholders, one thing I do hope that they can say is that I have been very open about and every question that I've asked, that there were no surprises here. I hope that they can say that because they know that then I'm coming at this in good faith, that I really want to am trying to incorporate their feedback, but I also ask lots of questions. I want to highlight something that Chris actually said right here, and that's that sometimes it gets messy. I don't think anything else rung more true than that, and I get that. I think that there is a level of fear in this that I've sensed from people about allowing some of these medications and that concern about it getting messy. But I want to say this, too, is that even when sober homes started to allow more of those medication-assisted treatments, and I think in your words there, was it got messy, but you worked through it, and I would... By all measures, these sober homes are incredibly successful still in what they're doing. I think that that is going to be what happens, even if, with some of the fear that's associated with this. But I am committed to try to figure out what else we can do to make my bill better. And with that, I would just ask that the bill be laid over for the possible inclusion in the Human Services Policy Bill.
Thank you, Vice Chair Frederick. House File 3954, as amended, is laid over. Next we have is House File 4149, another bill from Vice Chair Frederick. I'm hoping to vote on this by 10 after 2. Vice Chair Frederick, would you like to please move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to refer House File 4149 to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Okay, Vice Chair Frederick has moved to refer. I believe you have an A1 author's amendment. Can you please move and explain your A1 author's amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The A1 author's amendment changes some language to refer to calendar days to business days. And it's also shortening a window of enrollment from 10 days to 5 days.
Okay, very good. Any questions for the author of the A1 author's amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the A1 author's amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion is approved, and we have the House File 4149 as amended before us. Vice Chair Frederick, if you'd like to give your introduction, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the sake of time, actually, I think I would just turn it over to testifiers to introduce the bill or to explain the different parts of the bill.
Okay, very good. From my understanding, we have Mr. Zerbes here to explain the bill. We'll give you 4 minutes to be able to do that. Thank you so much for being here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Brian Zerbes. I'm the executive director of MARCH. MARCH is a statewide trade association for substance disorder programs and professionals. The slide deck we have is available for everyone. I'm going to be giving kind of a state of the state for SUD, touching on both this bill and the next bill coming up, as well as doing a walkthrough of 4149. So the why and kind of what's building into this, I want to give quick information about the treatment landscape. There are currently 417 active SUD programs in the state, 12 withdrawal management, 18 detox programs, scattering across the state. Just for reference, 50 of Minnesota's 80 counties has a treatment program licensed physically in that county. DHS licensing data, so lots of content on here. What I want to draw committee members' attention to is in the 2022 year and 2023, in that far right column, it indicates the number of net closures. So in any given year, there's a number of programs open, some programs close. But over the last 2 years, there's been a net decrease of 45 licensed programs in the state. Two of those programs opened in the 1970s. Five of those programs opened in the 1980s. These are long-term programs that aren't fly-by-night operations that are closing. Within that data, there's also adolescent programs closing to the tune of 6 programs over the last 2 years of adolescent-focused treatment programs have closed. Within the data, there's also an impact on greater Minnesota. When I looked at the programs that closed in the 7-county metro area compared to the 80 counties in greater Minnesota, in 2022, 42% of those programs closed in greater Minnesota. In 2023, 41% of all programs closed. And within residential programs in 2023, two-thirds or 5 of 8 programs closed in greater Minnesota. So again, when that happens, it creates a major access issue. Also, MARCH represents substance disorder professionals in the state. We recently conducted a survey. We had 627 survey responses back, and we were asking how long have you been in the field? So you can see the green part of the slide shows that the majority of responses are people that have been around for more than 5 years. We got responses back from 137 different zip codes, and 3/4 of the responses were from direct care staff, so counselors, nurses, technicians. And what one of the questions was, in the last 12 months, have you considered leaving the field? What this slide shows, the blue is yes. It's just over 50% of all of our survey respondents indicated they've thought about leaving. When asked how likely will you leave, fortunately, 75% said that they're not likely to leave in the next year. However, 25% did indicate that they're planning on moving on. We asked about stress, and one question was, what's the one thing that stresses you out the most? So across all of these answers, caseload, program needs was number one, paperwork issues number two, not having enough staff or having inexperienced staff was number three, and client activity. So again, we're on the message of hope. We have we have gritty workers. We have people that are dedicated to doing this work. And continuing on, what we need is immediate relief and some long-term structural changes. Data in here from the state on admissions, I'll kind of skip over that. Last takeaways, overdose deaths, this content has been presented in this committee already. Overdose deaths are at an all-time high. There's adverse impact for Black Minnesotans and American Indian Minnesotans. And then this last slide is the rate study from Burns & Associates was already presented to this committee. What the slide shows is the blue column is the current rates. The kind of orange column is the cost the vendor identified to provide those rates. So in short, we'll touch on rates in the next bill a little bit. So the overview of 4149. So Section 1 is expanding alternative paths to licensure. There's testimony provided from Hazel and Betty Ford that was provided to the committee. ASAM certification and alternative licensing inspections is in Section 2. Sections 3 and 5 touch on trying to align Minnesota program standards with ASAM in the number of hours for medical staff, mental health staffing, having flexibility for residential programs, when documenting engagement and having federal holidays be off for counselors. The Behavioral Health Fund affidavit would be touching on what Representative Frederick identified in changing 10 calendar days to 5 business days to have counties enroll people in the Behavioral Health Fund. And then the hard deadline for paperwork reduction will be touched on in further testimony. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my testimony for this part of the bill and pass it off to the other testifiers.
Thank you so very much for the presentation. Next, I have Anderson St. George. If you'd like to please come forward. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. You have 2 minutes for your testimony. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share this morning. I drove 185 miles just to be here this morning. I'm the CEO of Daystar Recovery Center, a residential treatment facility providing services to the underserved in rural Minnesota. I am a MARCH board member. I'm a member of the Governor's Advisory Council on Opioid and Substance Use Disorder. I'm a board member of the Hazelden Graduate School of Addiction Studies, and I'm the chair of the World Health and the and Disparities. And as part of our data collection, we find out that we have 3 major disparities in rural Minnesota: housing, transportation, workforce crisis. And I'm afraid if we're not doing anything, we're going to have a treatment disparity because we will not have access to treatment because majority of the colleagues that I work with already closed their treatment facilities. I was going to standardize my presentation, but I'm going to tell you really quickly that last week I've reached a breaking point. As the CEO of a treatment center, at times I provide clinical services. And recently one of our intake provider quit on us because of his mental health. Like, this field is getting too much for me. I have to quit. So I ended up providing clinical services, running the business, doing the intake provider services, and providing transportation. I'm picking up clients from 40 miles away, 50 miles away, bring them to treatment per se. And then with the workforce crisis, 1 week I was providing services. Friday I'm looking forward to go home, but we have to provide clinical services with the new 1115 waiver. Saturday I came to provide group for 2 hours, and then the staff who was supposed to work that weekend called in. I ended up working a double that day, and I was supposed to be there for only 2 hours. And then the following day, I had to work a double. And matter of fact, I worked so hard that week, and I worked so many hours, even my dog was mad at me. I'm serious. I have a lab husky. He's a high-energy dog. He wants me to walk him. I didn't have time to be at my house. I have a 1-year-old son. I didn't have time to spend time with him. So there is a major disparity. Our workforce is spread thin right now, and I really recommend you guys to do something about it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your experiences with us. Next, I have Lance Egli, who is virtual with us. Thank you for being able to be here today. Appreciate it. If you'd like to go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, Vice Chair and Bill Author Fredericks, and other committee members. My name is Lance Egli. I've completed a postdoc in the organization and financing of mental health services at the University of California, trained the Red Lake Nation Chemical Health staff for 19 years, coordinated the Bemidji State University CD minor, and spent the last 6 years focused on paperwork reduction and systems improvement. Today, I'm testifying on behalf of MARCH concerning that portion of House File 4149 that moves forward the deadline of paperwork reduction and systems improvement report from DHS to the Minnesota Legislature to December 15th of 2024. Our efforts so far have 3 major accomplishments and a number of smaller ones. We reduced the frequency with which treatment plans are required to be reviewed, which is going to allow providers to reduce the previous 50% of reviews they did without any changes, and thus have more time for the ones that are needed. We've reduced the portion of utilization management reviews under the 1115 waiver from 100% of claims to 10% of outpatient and 15% of residential. And many of the suggestions for improving the operation of direct access have been adopted. The existing legislation on paperwork reduction requires the Minnesota Department of Human Services to contract with a consultant as an important component And we expect to see some additional significant achievements from that. DHS has taken three quarters years, really, to contract with the consultant required in this enabling legislation, a process that normally takes no more than 6 months. We just can't depend on the Behavioral Health Division to bring the material forward in a timely fashion. The consultant finishes their work June 30th, 2024. If we don't move the deadline forward, we will miss an entire legislative session before considering the recommendations. The current DHS report deadline would be September 30th, 2025. We want to move it to December 15th, 2024. I would be happy to answer any questions or comment on any further responses.
Thank you very much, Mr. Egli, and thank you for being able to be with us today. First of all, is there anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? Not seeing any, I will then move to members. Any questions or comments, members? Not seeing any. Oh, excuse me, Representative Edelson. Didn't see you there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, I just wanted to thank your testifier for driving 185 miles here today and for all of the work that he's doing. It doesn't go unnoticed, and thank you.
All right. Any other comments? Vice Chair Frederick, I invite you to make closing comments and to renew your motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. It's a good bill, some of which, as kind of was outlined too, is building on the work that this committee and the legislature have done in the past. So I would appreciate the support. And with that, I would renew my motion to refer House File 4149 to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Vice Chair Frederick moves to re-refer House File 4149 as amended to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed saying nay. Motion is approved and House File 4149 as amended is re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. Thank you to all our testifiers who are here today, those that drove quite a way, thank you, and those who are coming in remote. Our next bill today is House File 4190 from Representative Baker. Welcome to the committee table here. If you'd like to, please move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing House File 4190 today. This is kind of a continuing story of what Vice Chair Frederick has also offered today. Again, just for saving time, we're going to make sure that we move to re-refer the House File 4190 to the Human Services Finance Committee, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. And Representative Baker, I understand you have an A1 amendment.
I do have an A1 amendment. I can explain it now if you want to.
If you would like to go ahead and explain it.
Yeah, thank you. So, and I think my testifier today, Brian Zerbis, will be able to do a better job than I can, because I know we're a little tight on time, but this is important to hear from our testifiers. This is a very aspirational bill that we have in front of you. It's very large. It's needed. Every single thing is needed. But we don't have any money. We don't have enough money. It's gone. And the thing that we need to do is to make sure that we can manage what we can use, what we can actually do today. And the amendment that I brought forward to really helps the workforce issue that's coming up a lot so that we've got managers and owners and directors that are literally at their end that can't do it anymore, because I hear that loud and clear. We've got to give some tools that we can work with on a short term that are up front, that are not something in the tails. And the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair and members, really provides a very nice tax credit for folks that are working more than part-time in our field. So with that, maybe I'll just turn it over to Mr. Zerbis to kind of explain the amendment, and then he can kind of carry on with the rest of it, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. I will go to Mr. Zerbis, if you'd like to go ahead and reintroduce yourself and speak to the A1 amendment, please.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. So on the A1 amendment, the tax credit was really created based on an all-member survey where we identified what's needed in the field. And this idea actually came up from one of our members to reduce barriers somewhat or to help out programs. It would create or expand upon a tax credit for people that work in SUD programs for more than 1,000 hours in a year. The second part of the A1 amendment is adding in MAXA to Section 10 of the bill, which is the transition support work group that I'll be touching on later. So we've had meetings with MAXA, and with their direction, they wanted to be added to that part of the bill.
Okay, very good. Are there any questions for the A1 author's amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of supporting the A1 author's amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries, and the A1 and House File 4190 is amended. Representative Baker, two-year bill.
And thank you for that, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm going to turn it right back over to our testifier to kind of go over through that as amended. Thank you.
Sounds very good. Mr. Zerbis, if you'd like to go ahead and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. So a brief overview of the bill. Sections 1, 2, and 3 we refer to as waiving fees for IDs. Again, this is looking at having people that have been to STD treatment be able to get their birth certificates, driver's licenses, or ID cards reinstated to them, but to not have a fee associated with that. Sections 4 and 5, it touches on group peer rates, so it would identify a ratio of peers. Section 6 is on substance disorder treatment effectiveness. That would direct the commissioner to work with STD providers to create a data dashboard on relevant STD data and then make that data available. Section 7 is would re-include substance disorder and the 3% rate increase and automatic inflation adjustment that happened last session. At the end of session, STD was carved out of that. Section 8 is extending the rate study. So the Burns & Associates was the vendor that did this large outpatient rate study. We feel they did a good job of capturing the cost of delivering STD services. But what was missed in that study was a rate evaluation for adolescent non-residential, adolescent residential withdrawal management, and room and board services. Section 9, it touches on the reentry waiver. So this would direct, this is the reentry waiver is already a feasibility study is underway. What we're looking at doing is having the application deadline moved up to January 2025. From all kind of accounts, it seems like it's a win-win-win. So we would not want to delay any further. And then lastly, Section 10 is this transition support work group. Again, this is looking at creating a work group of stakeholders that would identify barriers that clients experience as they go in and out of treatment, specifically touching on housing, transportation, child care assistance, food assistance, and come up with recommendations to come back in a subsequent legislative session. We've had good support and work. I want to thank, obviously, our authors, Representative Baker and DHS. The Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy has worked with us on this. The Rural Alliance of Treatment, MERITAP, providers have also been involved in this. And with that, I'll pass it off to our other testifiers.
Okay, thank you very much. I want to remind our testifiers that we do have a two-minute limit on testimony. The first person I have is Tim Walsh. If you'd like to come down, please. Introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Thank you for taking the time to be here with us at the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Tim Walsh. I'm the CEO of North Star Regional Treatment Services. I am a licensed psychologist. I also have my doctorate in public policy and administration. And I want to speak to the Section 7. We are a part of the behavioral health system. Most of us provide mental health services, our co-occurring treatment. We provide within our SUD treatment model, it's an integrated behavior model, and yet inexplicably we were excluded last year from the increase, the 3% increase with the automatic inflator, and just plainly we feel that that was unjust, and we're hoping that that can be corrected. I want to provide some data to support that. As you know, there's a rate methodology study that has been completed that is showing on average a 68% increase in our rates. That's just to keep pace with cost. A 3% doesn't even keep pace with inflation. As Brian was saying, that's it equals out to two programs per month that are being closed. And when you're saying we're at the end, we're at the breaking point, that's what we mean. There's only 417, and we have two programs going out of business every month. We serve over 60,000 Minnesotans, your constituents, every year. That represents only 10% of the people who need SUD treatment. And so multiply that figure, and that is the need that is out there. And so we are asking, because we are at that breaking point, we're asking for inclusion in last year's 3% increase and also the automatic inflator. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, I have Gina Evans. If you'd like to please come down. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
My name is Gina Evans, chair and members of the committee. My name is Gina Evans, and I serve as chair of the Government Affairs Committee for March and in Legislative Affairs for Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this crucial piece of legislation, and thank you to the authors who have worked tirelessly to get this right. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, in 2018, Minnesota lost 342 daughters, sons, husbands, mothers to opioid use disorder. Just 5 short years later, in 2022, that number has nearly tripled to over 1,000. That's an increase of 292%. These numbers are tragic. These families are forever changed. I don't have to tell this body that humans are our greatest resource. As Brian mentioned, from the survey of 620 substance use disorder workers, 50% are experiencing burnout. Minnesota is not alone in this. Nationally, the U.S. is experiencing a behavioral health workforce crisis. Strategies like increases to reimbursement rates, automatic inflation adjustments, and student loan relief are just some of the ways states are battling back. I'm not only an employee of Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, but also a byproduct of the great evidence-based trauma-informed care that programs across our great state pride themselves on. But this kind of care comes at a cost. Minnesota MNTC provides annual cost of living raises to our employees, but if reimbursement rates don't align, this is obviously not a sustainable business model. In 2023, SUD programs were left out of the rate increases that many other direct care industries received. We are asking this legislature, in light of recent program closures and the continued rise in overdose rates, to provide the SUD field a rate increase this year so that we can continue to help Minnesotans struggling with substance use find the best version of themselves. Thank you guys for the work you do. I appreciate you.
You're welcome, and thank you for being here, and thank you for the work that you're doing.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Next, I have R. John Sutherland. If you'd like to please come down. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Please introduce yourself, who you're with, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and committee members. My name is Roy John Sutherland. I am a licensed psychologist, licensed alcohol drug counselor. I'm vice president of addiction services for NYSERM and Associates, and co-chair of the government committee's affair for March. So I want to talk a little bit about the reimbursement rates that my fellow folks have just spoke about. In order to provide SUD services, there are several factors that impact our businesses and our programs to operate. One, volumes and reimbursements. Two, fixed expenses, largely labor costs, about 75%. And in order to cover our fixed expenses, you either have to increase volumes, increase reimbursement rates, or cut expenses. I know from my experience, we've cut almost every expense that we possibly can. It's difficult to increase our volumes as our volume ratios are set by DHS, and increasing the volumes would only add to burnout and providers leaving the field and not so great treatment for our patients. Rate reimbursement increases. As noted, our current reimbursement rates are barely covering our fixed expenses, resulting in program closures and decreased access. I'm asking this body to vote to reinstate the 3% rate reimbursement rate that was taken out of our behavioral health funding bill last year. In addition, long term, we must have an overhaul of our reimbursement rates as recommended by our outside independent consultants who studied these rate increases needed to cover our operation expenses. If we don't act quickly, more programs will close, resulting in increase in SUD and mental health problems and restricting access. I must say, I've been in the field for almost 20 years, and this is probably the worst it has ever been for being able to provide services for these people who have increased mental health acuity and substance use problems. We have our crisis in our hands. We're not going into a crisis. We're in it. I thank you so much for listening to my testimony, and I hope that you will vote to reinstate these reimbursement rates and to do structural changes in our reimbursements in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next, are there any other testifiers who would like to address the committee? Hearing none. Members, are there any comments or questions? Vice Chair Frederick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Representative Baker for carrying this bill. There's a lot of really good things in it. I think that we know we need to put more money into this space. As has said by previous testifiers, people are dying, and so the more work that we can do, the better. But there's even little things in the bill talking about birth records and state identification cards, which is such a human approach to things, too, because people who are coming out of treatment often don't have even those things. And how do you get a job? How do you get housing without some basic forms of identification like that? So I think there's a lot of really good things in this bill, and I just want to say thank you for carrying it.
Very good. Not seeing any other comments, Representative Baker, I invite you to make any closing comments and to renew your motion.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, thanks for bringing that up, Representative Frederick. Again, this does some really important things. Getting out of treatment, maybe out of incarceration, people's lives are in absolutely upside down. Getting them their birth certificate or driver's license, this is a very small ask. Let's help them get there. The 3% reduction or the reimbursement should have never been dropped last year, and it was. We've got to find that. And again, if we can do something for the help and for keeping these employees in the field, this is where we need to really fight for this area. Again, you know my work on ORAC and all of our work in opioid stuff and substance use disorder. But we're losing 40-plus providers in the last 2 years. All the work we're doing, we're having less people take care of them. And that's the places to go, not even the workforce. This is actually the physical places where how we can help people. So, members, this needs to be our focus this year. This bill is super important. March and Meritap and others have done a lot of work to make sure that we brought the right things to our table this year. And let's really do everything we can to scratch and fight for any dollars that we can get, because this reimbursement is almost – it's so short anyway, but it'll be a signal to the community to hang in there just a little bit longer, because we have to do more in the future. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 4190 as amended will be referred to the Human Services Finance Committee.
Representative Baker moves to re-refer House File 4190 as amended to the Human Services Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion is approved and House File 4190 as amended is re-referred to the Human Services Finance Committee. Thank you to our testifiers. Thank you, Representative Baker. Our final item on the agenda today is House File 4308 from Representative Keel. Lead Keel, welcome to the committee. Please move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move to re-refer House File 4308 to the General Register.
Okay, very good. And I understand you have an A1's author amendment. Would you please move and explain your amendment?
I would do that. I move to adopt the author's amendment. This amendment lines it up with the Senate bill, I believe. And the bill itself, we can have Maureen Schneider join us from the Board of Aging, but in our urgency to make sure that people who are signing up for additional help, like assisted living, have all kinds of checks and balances, and it has really been it is challenging. I actually experienced it myself this year as my parents moved into assisted living, and I just really feel that this is a way we can unencumber some of the requirements. I just can't imagine how somebody who's got health issues and challenges, you know, needs help already, and we're just a little too complicated. So with that, I would ask if our testifier could speak, and I believe, okay. Are we on virtual?
I see our testifier there, but before we go to the testifier, I do want to get the motion to approve the A1. So
I got ahead of myself.
Yeah, that's all right. That's all right. I appreciate you wanting to move us along. Is there any further member discussion on the A1 author's amendment? Not seeing any, all in favor of adopting the A1 author's amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails, and the A1 author's amendment is adopted. Back to House File 4308, and we will go to our testifier that we have, Maureen Schneider. I believe you're out there. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. If you'd like to please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here with you today. I am the interim chair for the Minnesota Board on Aging, and I'm here to speak to you regarding the House File 4308. I remember back to the 2000 legislation when this became a statute, and it did make sense at the time. However, since that time, it has become cumbersome. It really is working upstream against efforts to provide elders and their families with the early intervention information that they need before they make possibly life-changing, usually expensive decisions that they need to make about care transitions. I am going to illustrate the importance of this policy change by giving you a story from my own life. I have had many aunties in my life because both sides of my family came from a number of siblings. But unfortunately, I am down to just one aunt, and she's 97 years old, very much in charge of her own affairs, active in her community, an award-winning volunteer, and totally engaged in life. Unfortunately, she fell and fractured her hip in November. She was transferred to a regional medical center for surgery and recovery, and then transferred back to her home in northwestern Minnesota for rehabilitation. She is very well served by family and friends, including her two daughters, who are both registered nurses. After some care coordination and other items that we needed to take care of regarding her ability to remain at home, it was determined that she would not be able to remain at home. Because of my deep love for her and because of my lifetime interest in aging, I made it a point to be in regular contact with her and with her two daughters as we were working through the arrangements. The arrangements were made that she would move into the assisted living, which is part of the campus of the hospital there in her small community. And the arrangements, as I said, were made, and everything was on schedule. I was calling my aunt on a very regular basis and reaching out to her to make sure that she was comfortable with the transition. We know that it can be scary at times. It's something unknown. It's something new. And in her particular case, she really, really did prefer to remain in her own residence. She seemed to be doing fine. The plans were made. I even knew which apartment number she would be moving into. On the day of the move-in, I called her, and it took a long time for her to be handed the phone. But when she came on the phone, I did my best to reassure her that this would be for the best, that she would be receiving excellent care, that she would have opportunities for socialization, and that the community around her would continue to love and support her. Then I asked her, what are you doing? How are things going? Are you about ready to move in? And she said, well, yes, I am ready. The apartment is ready for me, and I'm just waiting. I'm sitting in the hall in my wheelchair, and I'm waiting. And I said, what are you waiting for? And she said, oh, well, my daughters have had to go down to the office to get something that they call a verification code. And that, ladies and gentlemen, was my aha moment. And I am hoping that we can eliminate that provision so that we can redeploy those resources to help people understand fully what their options are as they age in the community. Thank you very much for your time today and for all your work on behalf of Minnesota's elders.
Thank you, Ms. Schneider. Thank you for being able to join us today and for your testimony. With that, I will ask, are there any other testifiers who would like to address the committee? Not seeing any, we'll go to any members' questions or comments. Members, any comments or questions? Not seeing any. Representative Keel, I invite you to make any closing comments and to renew your motion.
I thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As I alluded to earlier,
I too was sitting in my parents' apartment at assisted living when I was informed that we had to get that number, which I felt a little silly about because I thought I would know everything that needed to be happening. And unfortunately, it was one of the end of the day. And like Maureen said, my folks were tired. This was just something we did not need to be doing. We had aired out all the things we wanted to do. And much to my father's disappointment at first, I moved him. But he tells me now, after 6 months, it was the right move. So it is challenging, but I think that this is important that we ease up on the requirements.
Okay, very good. With that, Representative Keel moves to re-refer House File 4308 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed signify by saying nay. Motion is approved, and House File 4308, as amended, is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you for the bill today, Representative Keel. Thank you to our testifiers. Our next hearing is going to be this coming Wednesday, March 13th. Yeah. We'll be hearing six bills from a variety of authors. Seeing there's no further business before this committee, we are adjourned.